Hello, my name is Dr. Francis Ferret. I'm the director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at Boston Medical Center and professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us today for Uncovering the Secret Sauce, Strategies for Increasing Prior Authorization Success Rates for Patients with Inflammatory Bowel Disease. This is the first of a three-part series designed to provide you with some best practice strategies that you can use to improve your success rates for prior authorization and to minimize the impact of prior authorization on staff administrative time, clinical workflow, and patient care. In part two of the series, we will highlight best practices in documentation in the electronic medical record to improve your prior authorization submissions. And in part three, we'll address denials and discuss strategies for the appeal process with the mindset that no doesn't necessarily mean no. Knowing that the activities will generate questions, we've created that platform so that you can submit your questions to us by completing the adjacent form. Responses to questions will be posted on the Gastroenterology Digital Hub at cmeoutfitters.com as part of a library of toolkits, templates, tracking spreadsheets, appeal templates, and patient education videos that you can use in your practice, and resources to share to use with team members that are also involved with the authorization process. Also, for those who complete the full series, CME Outfitters will provide a Certificate of Excellence in Prior Authorization. Prior authorization is clearly a team sport. Depending on the size and makeup of your practice, prior authorization may be handled by a medical assistant, a nurse practitioner, physician assistant, physician, or even the specialty pharmacist. So our panel reflects that diversity. With me today are my esteemed colleagues, Michelle Rubin and Tony Zahorian. Michelle Rubin is an advanced practice nurse and associate director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center and director of advanced practice nursing at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks, Frank.
Tony Zahorian is a clinical pharmacy specialist at the Center for Digestive Disorders at Boston Medical Center, and we work together in the office on all of these issues that we'll be discussing today. Welcome to the program, Tony.
Thank you.
In this first module, we are going to be focusing on improving processes for prior authorization. Our learning objective is to evaluate prior authorization methods that best fit clinical workflow to reduce disruption, establish clear communication with the payer, and minimize delays to treatment. We recognize that while the processes are the same, private practices do not have the same resources that we are fortunate to have in the academic medical center setting. So to be sure that we are addressing the challenges you face, I've reached out to a number of GI practices that refer patients to me to better understand some of the day-to-day challenges of prior authorization. As you can see from the clinician on the left, he's complaining of the fact that there's significant use of office resources that have continued only to grow in the past 10 years. They have their medical assistants do the work, but when all is said and done, there's a delay in getting recommended treatment and decreased patient satisfaction. For the clinician on the right, one of the things that she's complaining most of is the fact that they often have to regurgitate the same information on different prior authorization forms because in one particular case, the correct one was not filled out. And again, at the end of the day, dealing with prior authorizations is the most cumbersome and the worst part of my job. And I would certainly echo that. I think that many of the clinicians listening to this presentation will also agree that prior authorizations is not particularly satisfying, though something that we all need to do to help our patients. I collected several other comments for the clinician on the left. You can see that when it comes to peer-to-peer, it's typically a battle of attrition. I think we do need to think of this as a battle. Basically, the insurance companies and the prior authorization companies have the number of folks who can basically push back, ask for more forms, and they have the numbers to basically wear you down. And this is something that, thankfully, in our practice with our pharmacy staff, we can often work to push back on these. And then finally, for the clinician on the right, you can see that she is mostly troubled by doing peer-to-peer reviews for imaging tests, but also has this for medications, but not as many. And in this particular case, it appears that the clinician submits a prior authorization for a medication, it's denied, and instead of doing a peer-to-peer, just makes the decision to accept the medication that the insurance company wants. So again, I'm sure that each and every one of you listening to this program have faced these typical battles. Michelle, The IBD Working Group did a survey recently on time spent on prior authorizations. Can you kind of fill us in on what they found?
Well, Frank, a whole lot of communication is going on here, and you know how aggravating that can be in a practice, and particularly when you have the individuals, perhaps an RN, MA, you know, they got a lot of other things they're doing in a day, and when you're spending so much time communicating, it doesn't go well often. It takes away from patient care as well. So in this particular study here, it was communication with barriers is frequent, and as you can see there, that greater than five times a day for 73% of these calls, they are on the phone. And the other aspect there, you see there's greater than 10 times daily that they are calling in a day, and that took up 30% of the calls. So 67% of calls for pre or reauthorization of biologics are made by healthcare providers, so either a physician, an RN, nurse practitioner, PA, or an MA. 9.35% of those calls are made by physicians. And then 63% of respondents dedicate at least 25% of a full-time equivalent. So that's a lot. But what's also very concerning here is that all the time that it's taking in a day for these practitioners, 30% of surveyed practices report that their office lacks a formal process for handling the PA workload.
Thank you, Michelle. That was very informative. Tony, there are a number of ways to submit prior authorizations. Is there one way that works better than the others?
Certainly, Frank. I think that's a wonderful question. You can see on the slide that most providers do use multiple channels to submit prior authorizations, and all of these do have their benefits and their role in practice. However, I would argue that electronic PAs are the most effective and the most efficient. This can often be done through medical prior authorization portals, such as CoverMyMeds. Extremely useful because it does speed up the process. It also allows you to save your prior authorization, so when that authorization expires, you can simply resubmit some of the work that was already done.
Thank you, Tony. I understand that you polled some colleagues to find out their tips and tricks, as well as some common roadblocks. Can you share that with us?
Of course. I would say that the tips on this slide reflect the universal tip overall of just making sure that you're prepared. So you mentioned that some of your colleagues struggled with making sure that they had the correct forms. A lot of this research can be done in advance. One of the tips that I would recommend is identifying the top insurers in your practice and researching online what their criteria are for covering particular medications. If you're aware of this criteria in advance, you can make sure that it is addressed on your prior authorization form. In addition, I would say it's important to know which insurance your patient has. So if you're submitting to the incorrect insurance company, this means that you're going to have to repeat on a different form in the future. So whether that means reaching out to the patient's pharmacy or reaching out to the patient directly to ensure that you are choosing that correct insurance and that correct form will certainly save you time. Hopefully your preparation will pay off, but if it doesn't, my next tip would just be to network. So make sure you have connections within the insurance companies and even within the specialty pharmacies that you commonly use themselves so that you can reach out and ask questions and get clarifications if needed. The other thing I would be sure to do is track your PAs. Oftentimes this process does take a few days or even up to a week, and it can be easy to forget which PAs have been submitted, which have been approved, and which are still waiting on a response. I would also recommend tracking wins and losses so you can practice what has been successful in the past and repeat that with future patients. All of these tips are really just in an effort to help you get it right the first time around. We often find that if it's done right the first time, you'll be successful, but the more times you have to go through this process for a particular patient or a particular medication, the more hurdles you have to jump over.
Thank you, Tony. I think these are all very practical for us to take back to our practices. Michelle, you're at the University of Chicago. It's a very large IBD center. Do you have a lot of templates that you use, and have they been useful in getting prior authorizations through?
Absolutely. We definitely have multiple templates put together for various biologics, for imaging, et cetera. It just makes it a much smoother process. You're not redoing a letter every time, so having standardized forms is definitely a time saver. And as I said, they can be created for multiple biologics. And we include standard documentation of the medical need, but can also be customized to each patient's particular need. If there's some psychiatric issues that are a complication and involved in this process, they can be added as well. And some excellent examples are also available online from the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. There are multiple different ones there for when you have to switch meds or when there is the step-up approach, and that is not the appropriate approach with the patient. They also have forms for that. So yes, standardization is absolutely imperative to have.
I know that in our practice, we use the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation forms as our template, and then we modify them as we move forward. So again, I would encourage all listeners to go to this particular website, download these forms, modify them if you feel they're appropriate, and then use them as your templates when submitting prior authorizations. So Tony, we work very closely together in the office. As a specialty pharmacist, how can you and your colleagues in the pharmacy help us get the appropriate drugs to our patients?
So I think this is another important topic to discuss. And I do want to mention the other important members of the pharmacy team. Aside from the pharmacists, there are also pharmacy technicians who are very helpful in the prior authorization process. Particularly, pharmacists are going to be most helpful with the clinical services, helping the provider decide on the proper medication, the proper dose, reviewing for drug interactions, and potentially even educating the patient on this new medication. A lot of these infusions and injections can be nerve-wracking for the patient, and so to provide that education upfront is often helpful. This can also be helpful once the medication is approved to provide education on the importance of adherence and follow up with the patient once they do have their medicine. Pharmacists and pharmacy technicians are also helpful with the non-clinical services. This includes paperwork, completing the PA process, setting up peer-to-peers, and also helping with financial assistance if a patient is uninsured or has a large copay. Ultimately, this can help the providers by saving them time that they can spend with their patients instead of doing prior authorizations and completing paperwork. It also benefits the patient because ideally the patient is then getting their medication in a more timely manner. They have the support of a medication specialist in the pharmacist. Ideally, this also means that patient satisfaction is improved and maybe even patient quality of life if they are able to obtain that medication.
Michelle, even with successful prior authorizations, copays can be a burden to patients, and they're very, very worried about these copays. Are there programs that can help ease the burden for our patients?
Absolutely, Frank. And it's very important to not forget about the copay assistance and achieving copays for your patients. And this should be something considered right up front when you're going to be putting a patient on these biologics, get them hooked in right away with the co-payment program. Co-pay assistance, they can supplement $12,000 to $20,000 a year. You know, these biologics are very expensive. And the patient can end up paying nothing to maybe $5 a month. This is a significant benefit for the patient. So it's imperative that you get these patients hooked up with a copay card. And as you can see, all the biologics that are listed here with the specific websites to sign up for their savings card.
Michelle, thank you for filling us in on what the options are for our patients who have commercial insurance. But what about patients with Medicare?
So with Medicare Part D, the options for coverage are much different. And obviously there is that initial deductible phase, and then you fall into this donut hole where the copays become much higher. And often patients cannot afford these copays because, you know, with a lot of these medications, and particularly the biologics, they are extremely expensive. So once they fall into this area, this donut hole, it's like, where do we go with them from there? And Tony, maybe you can inform us on what happens at this point and from here, where do we go with patients?
I think this is important because patients who do not have commercial insurance, so those Medicare patients, do not qualify for the programs discussed on the previous slide. So oftentimes what will happen is the pharmacy will notice a high copay, and we can switch this coverage from pharmacy through Medicare Part D to medical benefit through their Medicare Part A and B. And this will cover the medication without a copay to the patient. They will still pay if it's an infusion to come in and sit down and receive the medicine, but they won't pay that high cost for the medication out of pocket.
And Tony, do they have to submit any tax forms or anything to assist with coverage under Medicare? Is that based on need?
Often not. They already have the Medicare Part A and B, and that does cover these medications. So you would just have to cancel your PA through the pharmacy insurance. You wouldn't need a prescription, and it would just get covered automatically.
Okay. Great.
Treating patients with Medicare, as you can see, can be very, very difficult. I would refer the listener to the series of links at the end of this program that can give you some other helpful hints on how to arrange for coverage for your patients with Medicare. So now we've discussed patients who have commercial insurance, patients with Medicare. I'd like Tony to tell us what to do if a person has no insurance at all. What can we do to help these patients?
This is another bit of a problematic patient population. They often do need medications that they cannot afford. There are a number of foundations for IBD patients that can assist with medication coverage. Unfortunately, a lot of the IBD disease state funds are often out of medications because they are utilized at such a high rate. However, we do have an alternative option in our patient assistance programs. These are extremely useful for those patients who do not have insurance, or maybe they had insurance and now they're in a gap phase. I know Frank and I had a patient like that recently. We are currently signing up for one of these patient assistance programs. As you can see on this slide, eligibility criteria do vary for the patient assistance programs, and there are websites available for each of the biologic medications. These websites can be accessed by your care team to help the patient apply for these funds.
This has been a great discussion today. We always want our goals to be SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. As we wrap up, let's leave the audience with some takeaways and action items to improve their PA process. Michelle, can you start off for us?
Absolutely. Number one, identify the top five insurers in your practice and know the information they require. That is of utmost importance, so when that you start this process, that you get it right the first time and it makes it go smoother from there on. Develop and download templates to use for PA. This just simplifies the process and expedites the entire process to getting the PAs filled out. Take advantage of EPA systems that allow you to submit online. This also expedites the process and sort of gives you a real-time look at what is going on with the system.
And Tony, can you bring us up with the last three SMART goals?
Certainly. Assess patient assistance programs to help bridge co-pays and provide coverage for those patients who do not have insurance or are in an insurance gap. Develop a tracking process to ensure that your PA requests do not get lost. And then finally, track your wins and losses. Make sure that if things are going well, they continue to go well. And if things aren't working, then you can tweak the process to make it better for your practice.
I'd like to thank Michelle and Tony for this very practical discussion and for sharing their insights, experience, and strategies for maneuvering the prior authorization process. Please visit the Gastroenterology Digital Hub at cmeoutfitters.com, where you will find all three modules, as well as template letters, checklists, and spreadsheets to help you build and improve your process. You will also find a video for patients explaining what they can expect from the process that you may find helpful. Thank you for joining us today. We sincerely hope that we were able to provide you with the tools to improve your processes, allowing for more time for patient education, meeting patients' medical needs, and improving outcomes in your patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Thank you. Hello, my name is Dr. Francis Ferre. I'm the director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at Boston Medical Center and a professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us today for best practices for electronic health record documentation to overcome barriers to prior authorization for patients with inflammatory bowel disease. This is the second module in the three-part series designed to provide you with some of the best practice strategies that you can use to improve your success rates for prior authorization and to minimize the impact of prior authorization on staff administrative time, clinical workflow, and patient care. If you haven't viewed part one, I encourage you to check it out. It gave some great strategies for easing the burden of prior authorizations on your daily workflow. In part three, we'll address denials and discuss strategies for the appeals process with a mindset that no doesn't necessarily mean no. Knowing that the activities will generate questions, we've created that platform so that you can submit your questions to us by completing the adjacent form. Responses to questions will be posted on the digital hub at cmeoutfitters.com as part of a library of toolkits, templates, tracking spreadsheets, appeal templates, and patient educational videos that can be used in your practice and resources to share and use with your team involved with the prior authorization process. Also, for those who complete the full series, CME Outfitters will award a Certificate of Excellence in Prior Authorization. With me today are my colleagues, Michelle Rubin from the University of Chicago and Tony Zahorian from Boston Medical Center. Michelle is an advanced practice nurse and associate director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center and director of advanced practice nursing at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Dr. Tony Zahorian is a clinical pharmacy specialist at the Center for Digestive Disorders at Boston Medical Center and works with me on a regular basis on these issues. Welcome to the program, Tony.
Thank you.
In this second module, we are going to be focusing on improving processes, documenting disease activity, and data that supports the use of biologics. Our learning objective is to implement a prior authorization protocol to improve documentation in the electronic health record and minimize barriers to medication approval. Prior authorization is not only an administrative burden, but it's a burden that can have severe consequences for our patients with inflammatory bowel disease. As you can see on this slide, there are requirements that step therapy that require patients to fail several therapies before gaining coverage for your prescribed treatment. Payer protocols can have dire effects on patient care and the personal and professional functioning and their quality of life. Variation in payer requirements and criteria can be a barrier to approval. Michelle, one of our struggles with prior authorization is that we often don't see eye to eye with a payer about what the appropriate initial medication to use. Is there data that support biologic therapy earlier in the course of disease for our patients with moderate to severely active ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease?
Yes, Frank. There have been multiple studies. This particular study right here looked at Crohn's disease, and it demonstrated to us that the patients with moderate to severe disease require the use of biologics initially, instead of the traditional approach where we started out with medications, not the biologics, but the mesalamines or different steroids and things initially, get them in remission. But those patients often that had the severe to the moderate disease really needed to start out with biologics earlier. And in the beginning, we were sort of making them earn the use for us to provide biologics for them.
Thank you very much for clarifying that for us, Michelle. I guess the next step, though, is to identify who has moderate to severely active Crohn's disease. And I know that the AGA clinical care pathways helped us. Can you review those for us?
Yes. This one here is the pathway for Crohn's disease. And as you see, on the left is low risk, and on the right is high risk. And in the middle there, you see the patient characteristics that qualify them as either low risk or high risk. In the next slide, this is the pathway for ulcerative colitis characterizing colectomy risk. And again, you see the parameters there, and the provider can then differentiate low risk or high risk for their patients. Now, these pathways are all evidence-based, and the expert GI IBD clinicians were involved in setting up this pathway.
Thank you again for helping us identify patients who have high risk characteristics of both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, because this is the group that potentially is likely to benefit from early use of a biologic. Tony, the AGA has developed clinical care pathways that we just discussed for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, and they were developed to help us guide treatment and decision making. Can you talk a little bit about the pathways and why they are important?
Certainly. As you mentioned, I do think these pathways help to guide your treatment decisions. This first slide reviews initial treatment for patients who are considered high-risk Crohn's disease patients. And as you can see, there are several treatment options available that are supported by the AGA when you are treating your patients in clinic. This slide reviews the AGA care pathway for ulcerative colitis, specifically in those patients who are considered high-risk. On the left hand of the slide, you have the induction therapy options, and on the right hand of the slide, you have the maintenance therapy options. So these will also be useful for your care team as you are developing and filling out your prior authorization forms.
Thank you, Tony. The AGA pathways provide clear guidance to us as clinicians as to which drug to choose in our patients with moderately severely active ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. Do the payer policies actually typically follow the same path?
Unfortunately, no. It would make life much easier if they did, but unfortunately, most of them do not follow the AGA care pathways. This slide presents data on a review of 50 payer policies, a majority of which you can see did not follow the AGA care pathways. Many of these policies also require that patients will fail two or more anti-TNF therapies before approving another biologic, vedolizumab.
Michelle, we always talk about setting ourselves up for success in this program. That begins with good documentation of the patient's disease activity in their electronic medical record. So now let's talk specifics. What should be in the chart and easily retrievable to make a good prior authorization case?
So first of all, you need to create a template for the electronic health record that includes, number one, your year of diagnosis for the patient with the ICD-10 code, and a detailed disease course. You really want to paint a good picture of this patient's clinical phases. You need to include colonoscopy, radiographic, and imaging results, type of disease, and area that is involved. And that's what you're going to get with the results of these examinations. You want to be sure you have the extent of disease documented. You want to document the pertinent lab results and imaging in one location of the notes, particularly your C-reactive protein, fecal calprotectin, which are inflammatory markers of inflammation, and also hepatitis B and TB testing, because these are also pertinent tests to have prior to starting biologics. The history of flares is very important. It needs to be understood if there are repeated flares and the medications are not working. As we said, all prior medication and failures in one section of the note. This is where a good templated note of clinical documentation is very important for the providers to have, so that the persons who are doing the prior auths have this information right there for them, and they can submit your note. And it's also very important to summarize the clinical need for new medication in the same place and include the reasoning for avoiding preferred options.
I would reinforce what Michelle just said. I think this is the first step in getting a particular drug approved. If you do not have a clear-cut picture of what the patient has been through, what they failed, and what their status is, you're less likely to be able to overcome a denial from an insurance company. So getting it right the first time, which we've said multiple times, often is the best way to get to the solution that you're trying to get to. So let's say you've submitted the prior authorization. How often do you or someone in your office have to talk to someone at the insurance company?
Well, fairly often if the initial prior auth did not have all the appropriate information in it to justify the need for the medication. So it can occur, you know, often, or even if there were mistakes in your first documentation that you sent in. So if a policy requires a step failure therapy of agents, we consider requesting a peer-to-peer to call to review the policy and request a standard care review. It's very important that you have the chart and the information that you supplied in your prior auth in front of you so that you have the information there that they need and require. If a peer-to-peer is required or desired, you want to request the same specialty-specific peer reviewer.
Yes, I agree with that. Whenever we do request a peer-to-peer, we always specifically ask to speak to a gastroenterologist who potentially has the insight and understands the nuances of why we're requesting a particular medication. Tony, outside the information in the chart itself, are there any other things that we should include when submitting a prior authorization that may make the case for a particular agent?
Certainly, I think it's important to provide evidence to support your argument, particularly if you've researched the insurance criteria and you know that there are certain steps you're hoping to skip. It's important to provide the reasoning for why you would like to do that. And oftentimes that does come through clinical trials or literature that's available online, or things even that you've seen at presentations in different conferences. You can also include the AGA care pathways. Honestly, prior authorizations can sometimes be many pages long if you are providing enough support for your argument. It is also important to provide information supporting drug-specific therapy, including mechanism of action, and again, data supporting use of potentially a patient who has not tried an anti-TNF and we're jumping to another biologic first. Really support your argument all the time.
Thank you, Tony. I think this is a key point in that we should be including the clinical care pathways, results from therapeutic drug monitoring, all the things that would make a cogent case for the reviewer to understand what we were asking for. I'd like Michelle and Tony now to wrap up this particular part two of our program discussing SMART goals in creating prior authorizations and getting our patients the appropriate therapies that they need.
So first off, create a process and a template in the electronic health record of essential information regarding the patient's disease that's going to support the medical need for the use of the biologic. You're going to want the year of diagnosis, the ICD-10 code, and a detailed course of their flares, et cetera, that they've been having. All the imaging, colonoscopy, radiographic evidence is very key. Any pertinent lab results, as we said previously, that are inflammatory markers possibly, as well as what are the TB and hepatitis B that need to be given to a patient prior to any start of biologics. History of flares, as I said before, and all prior medication failures is also very key. Why are we switching to the biologics, or why are we changing to a different mechanism of biologics?
So that was a good summary of all the subjective and objective information to include, Michelle. I'd also say that it's important to summarize your assessment and plan for the patient, including literature to support that plan that you have developed. In addition, I would say you want to include the AGA care pathways, specifically if this is something that you have decided to follow.
I know this can seem daunting in terms of having to include all this information, but it's in your electronic medical record anyway. So just find a way to consolidate it, because that first submission is the one that's most likely to be approved. And so taking the time to put this in one place, easily reviewable by the person at the insurance company, is more likely to lead us to success on the first go-round. I'd like to thank Michelle and Tony for this very practical discussion and for sharing their insights, experience, and strategies for developing best practices for clinical documentation with an eye on prior authorization. Please visit the Gastroenterology Digital Hub at cmeoutfitters.com, where you'll find all three modules, as well as template letters, checklists, spreadsheets to help you build or improve your processes in obtaining prior authorizations. You'll also find a video for patients explaining what they can expect from the processes that you may find helpful. Thank you for joining us today. We sincerely hope that we are able to provide you with the tools to improve your clinical documentation processes, to increase prior authorization success, and most importantly, improve clinical outcomes in your patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Hello, my name is Dr. Francis Ferret. I'm the director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at Boston Medical Center and a professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you for joining us today for No Doesn't Necessarily Mean No, Strategies for Successful Prior Authorization Appeals for Patients with Inflammatory Bowel Disease. This is the third of a three-part series designed to provide you with some best practice strategies and actions you can take when your prior authorization is denied, and to discuss strategies for the appeals process with the mindset that no doesn't necessarily mean no. Part one of the series highlighted the workflow strategies to improve your prior authorization success. And in part two, we addressed best practices in the electronic health record documentation. Knowing that the activities will generate questions, we've created a platform so you can submit your questions to us by completing the adjacent form. Responses to the questions will be posted on the Gastroenterology Digital Hub at cmeoutfitters.com as part of a library of toolkits, templates, tracking spreadsheets, appeal templates, and patient education videos that can be used in practice, and resources to share for use with your team that's involved with the prior authorization process. And for those of you who complete the full series, CME Outfitters will award a Certificate of Excellence in Prior Authorization. Our panel today reflects the diversity of the team that contributes to the successful prior authorization appeal. With me are my colleagues, Michelle Rubin from the University of Chicago and Tony Zahorian from Boston Medical Center. Michelle is an advanced practice nurse and associate director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center and director of advanced practice nursing at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you.
Dr. Tony Zahorian is a clinical pharmacy specialist at the Center for Digestive Disorders at Boston Medical Center and my colleague in the gastroenterology department there. Welcome to the program, Tony.
Thank you.
In this third module, we're going to be focusing on the appeals process when a prior authorization is denied. Our learning objective is to develop a process for an organized and clinically supported appeal for prior authorizations that are inappropriately declined. In our first module, as you can see on this slide, we describe some of the best practice tips for successful prior authorization. You need to identify the top five insurers in your practice, know if they use an electronic prior authorization form, know their phone, email, and fax numbers, what are their processes and criteria, and be sure clearly to use the right forms. You need to monitor measures. You need to know the information that they typically require in their prior authorization. Designate a payer point of contact to own the process. Develop a tracking process to ensure requests don't get lost. When submitting several prior authorizations, you can lose track of an authorization that was submitted several days ago and you've yet to hear from the insurance company. And clearly track both wins and losses. In Module 2, we discuss the important clinical elements to routinely document in the patient's electronic medical record to ensure that if you need to get a prior authorization, all the information needed is already contained in the record. So for example, on this slide, create a template whenever possible for the electronic medical record that includes the year of diagnosis, detailed disease course, include their colonoscopy, imaging results, the type of disease, ulcerative colitis versus Crohn's disease, is it pancolonic ulcerative colitis, is it ileocolonic Crohn's disease, do they have perianal involvement? Include in the template what their inflammatory markers are, their CRP, their fecal calprotectin. Many insurers require that we document hepatitis B immunization and that they've been tested for TB and they're not exposed. Include in the electronic record how often they've had disease flares. We really want to paint a picture of how this particular patient is suffering with their disease. And all prior medication and failures should be in one section of the note. At the end of your note, summarize the clinical need for a new medication while you're moving on to a new class of drugs or a different agent, and include reasoning if you're requesting an agent that's not their preferred agent. So despite even your best efforts, documenting what we reviewed in Module 1 or 2, denials still happen in our patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Michelle, is this specific to IBD or is it happening in other fields?
No, it's happening in other fields as well. And this slide here demonstrates, it was a doctor-patient rights project. And this showed a denial for chronic disease medication areas. And as you can see here, one in four were denied coverage. So 55% of denials were for medication, 29% of individual denied coverage reported a deterioration in their health as a result.
So we can see clearly this is not a problem just for patients with inflammatory bowel disease.
Absolutely not. So as you can see, Frank, it's not just in IBD. But let's take a look at how it is in the inflammatory bowel disease group. So 49% of gastroenterologists reported an experience with a patient who was stable on maintenance therapy but had to stop due to a denial. You know, that can be devastating on the health for the patient. 62% indicated that reimbursement barriers have resulted in modification of biologic chosen. And 17% stated that this occurred frequently. So as you can see, this is really, we have to be on top of these, getting these reimbursements and getting our prior auths to the best they can be. As far as the documentation needed to make sure that denials do not occur.
Yeah, I would reiterate that. This is something that we do see in our practice, and it clearly disrupts patient care and in many situations can lead to an exacerbation of their disease. Tony, so when you do get a denial letter, where do you start? How do you go about supporting the IBD practice in appealing the denial?
I find that a good first place to start is just finding out why the prior authorization was denied in the first place. Sometimes this is something simple. Some information was missing. Maybe they just want more information about prior medications or hepatitis B testing. This can just be added and sent back in. Not all payers will require an appeal after an initial denial, so occasionally you'll get multiple chances to submit your prior authorization before you reach the appeal stage and before you need to do a peer-to-peer. Occasionally, denials are a bit more severe. Maybe they decided that this was not medically necessary or did not meet the clinical rationale based on their criteria. At this point, you may need to submit additional literature or actually do the peer-to-peer to support why you've made this clinical choice. Other reasons for denial include simply that you've selected the wrong form. This can be easily avoided by using electronic medical prior authorization platforms such as CoverMyMeds. This would allow you to select the patient's insurance and then actually provides you with the correct form for that medication so that you do not have to fill out a form and then redo all the work that you've already completed.
Thank you, Tony. So we've received a denial. Tony pointed out some of the ways to appeal the denial. I guess in your practice, Michelle, do you always appeal?
Yes, we always appeal. You have to be the patient advocate here, and it's very important that you do work toward getting an approval for them. So first of all, the denial letter is often going to offer options of how to submit an appeal. So really look at the denial letter and look at what they are requiring. Ask for a peer-to-peer reviewer, and I would say particularly in a situation where their requirements are sort of based on the step-up approach, and they need to talk to the provider to understand, no, this patient may have moderate to severe disease, and we need to start out with a biologic in the beginning and looking at their risk factors. Submit the letter of medical necessity, clinical trials, abstracts, office visit notes. Utilize supporting literature and referring evidence, particularly like our AGA guidelines and the clinical pathway that we talked about in the previous module. Be assertive and be persistent. You are the patient's advocate, and we want to get these drugs approved for these patients. Exhaust every level of appeal available. And looking there on the right side is moving from peer-to-peer, your first appeal, second appeal, sometimes an external appeal is needed. And if nothing there seems to work, then appeal to the State Department of Insurance. And often you will get the approval you need.
Thank you, Michelle. So now let's talk about the elements that go into a successful appeal. Tony, what should clinicians be thinking about when they sit down to craft an appeal?
As Michelle mentioned, I think this is really your opportunity to advocate for the patient. And I do think it is important to include in your letter all of the objective information that led to your plan to choose this particular medication. But what makes an appeal letter unique is this is your opportunity to provide more of a narrative on the patient's condition. So not only that objective information, but also subjective information about how the patient is doing, and sort of weave that into a story about the patient's condition, including their lab values, their previous medication trials, and their current symptoms. You should also make sure to reference these choices. So make sure you're including literature and a reasoning behind what you're doing to support your argument. At the end of the letter, I would recommend supporting your concerns about inadequate treatment. So potential hospitalizations for your patient, emergency room visits, or even surgery, and what that could mean for your patient's quality of life, and also increased healthcare costs. When writing a letter, an appeal letter, it is important to offer to provide any additional information that might be required at the end of the letter. Make sure that you write this letter on an official letterhead and it's signed by the provider with the correct contact information in case they do need to reach you for additional information. And probably most importantly is follow instructions. Each payer will have different instructions as far as how their denial letter should be written, and you want to make sure to follow those so that you do not have additional problems.
Michelle, are there resources and template for appeal letters just like they are for the initial submissions to the insurance company?
Yes, there are appeal templates. And once again, it's very important to use those. It just makes it more efficient and simplified for you when submitting them. But there are ones that are for Crohn's disease, for ulcerative colitis, and there's letters that are for drugs that may be for both. And as we said, this can expedite the process. The Crohn's and Colitis Foundation has excellent templates that you can get off the website.
Michelle, where do you go to find other resources to support your appeal letter?
Well, you can ask colleagues and experts in the field of IBD to help you support that. The Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, as you see, there is a link here. They have multiple appeal letters there that you can use and customize for your patients. There also is the online evidence summaries, the uptodate.com, where it has your most current information on the treatment pathways, etc. Here you also, we talked about earlier in our previous module about the AGA Crohn's disease clinical care pathway and the AGA ulcerative colitis clinical care pathway that you can use as evidence to support your use of the biologics. And in addition, you can search IBD journal websites. And Tony, can you tell us what you do when you search for IBD journals?
So I think the important thing to note about this is that it can seem overwhelming because it can be certainly time consuming. Yeah. And so what I find to be really useful is to do the literature search and save the work that I've previously done as a PDF on my computer so that when I have future patients who might require a similar treatment with the same literature, that I have that saved and I don't have to do the research from scratch. This is helpful, but you also want to make sure that you're updating that literature when new things become available.
Yes, that's right.
Tony, in our first module, we heard from the gastroenterologist that I had surveyed a lot about their peer-to-peer review experience. What exactly are they?
A peer-to-peer is an opportunity to discuss the denial that you've received and present new clinical information that could potentially reverse this denial. It is important that although you might be frustrated at this point in the process, not to be combative with the reviewer. It's important to start off by thanking them for their time to review the case. Also take into account the reviewer's perspective. They must apply the payer's coverage guidelines and use their clinical judgment to render the appropriate decision. So hopefully you're on the same page, but they do have multiple things to consider. I would also recommend requesting a same specialty reviewer. Michelle mentioned this earlier. If you find a reviewer that you've worked with before that has worked out well, you could also save the name of that person and request them for future reviews.
So Michelle, Tony just reviewed with us some of her tricks for embarking on a peer-to-peer review. What do you do in your clinical practice to increase your odds of obtaining the appropriate medicine for your patient?
Well, I definitely prepare ahead of time. I review the denial letter and make sure that we are addressing the reasons for the denial. So definitely you need to have the patient's chart in front of you, re-examine it for any concerns that were noted in the denial letter so that they get covered. Schedule the peer-to-peer at a time when you are readily available. Provide a phone number where you can be reached. This is very important so that you coordinate the timing that is appropriate for both. Confirm that the payer received the correct and complete documentation with the initial submission. We often know that faxes get lost in this underground world of faxes that never get viewed. Or someone else takes the faxes off the machine. So you definitely want to make sure that they do have the right and correct documentation. Ask if the reviewer has had a chance to review your documentation. That is very important as well. In addition, explain your case. Be succinct. Provide facts from the clinic notes. Be sure that you are working off the clinic notes so that you're all on the same page. And be sure that you are painting a picture of that patient's clinical focus. Support your case if asked to submit additional information. Be timely. Don't wait a couple weeks. Get it out to them as soon as you can. Otherwise, this just further delays the approval. Document the outcomes. get an authorization number if provided, verify the peer reviewer's name and credentials. If successful, ask for the same reviewer when for future denials. Understand the next step. Often it's very important to reiterate back what the understanding is of what the next steps are needed.
Tony, we covered patient assistance programs in Module 1, but I think a review would be valuable for clinicians in case the appeal is denied. What's available for these patients in which the appeal is denied and they cannot get a particular medication through their insurance company?
Great question, Frank. There are many foundations that do provide assistance to our IBD patients who have not been approved for their medications or potentially who don't have insurance at the time that they need treatment. Unfortunately, many of the sites listed here and the foundations, chronic disease state funds specifically, oftentimes do run out of money because this is a very common disease state and these funds are utilized up very quickly. For those patients who still need assistance, there are patient assistant programs. However, the eligibility criteria do vary, and we again discuss this in Module 1. So it's important to review those criteria and make sure that your patient does qualify for this patient assistance program. The programs listed here on this slide vary based on the biologic of that you are trying to select. So you simply just go to the website and register the patient.
Michelle, we get very frustrated as providers by this process, but clearly this is nothing compared to what our sick patients are going through. As we initiate this process, how do you, as a frontline clinician seeing these patients every day, manage their expectations while we're waiting to hear from the insurance company?
Well, first of all, I really keep in contact with these patients and, you know, open discussions between them that, yes, there is an appeal process. It may take a little bit of time, but we are going to try and expedite the information they want, and we're going to try and expedite this process for you so that we can get you on the appropriate medications. And so discussing possible timelines is very important because there's nothing like leaving a patient out there hanging. They know they need this medication and they're just getting sicker in the meantime. So you kind of want to give them some timelines as to what the expectations can be. And the electronic prior authorization process and all of that does help expedite that sometimes. But it's very key that we do get all the appropriate information from the patient and the clinicians in this process. So we kind of tell them what the process is and why it takes a little time. And then always discuss backup plans and availability of patient assistance. If we get another denial, what can we do in the meantime here? And then let them know about a patient assistant programs, just as Tony had talked about in the last slide or two. And medication education. This is another great time to educate them about the medications and the biologics to sort of keep them engaged and involved that we have every plan that we are going to move forward this and we want to maintain a positive attitude with this patient. We will get this approved.
Thank you, Michelle. Clearly our patients are suffering and anything we can do to move the process in a quicker way, it would be appreciated by all. In fact, one of the ways that GI societies are dealing with this is by going to Washington. So maybe Tony can update us on where legislation is in Washington to be able to respect our patients' rights to get the right medicines.
Sure. So the Restoring Patients' Voice Act would provide patients and providers with a clear, equitable, and transparent appeals process when they are subject to the Step Up therapy protocol or criteria. This act is supported, or this proposed legislation is supported by the AGA, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, and the ACG. So you as a provider and your state GI or local medical societies can work with state legislature to improve access for your patients and also support this legislation.
I want to reinforce what Tony just said. A famous politician said that all politics is local. In our state of Massachusetts, we are actually working with the state legislature to try to come up with a more equitable way for patients to avoid step edits to receive appropriate medicine. So I would encourage all of the listeners to reach out to their local GI society and see whether you can engage them in moving forward with local legislation in your own state. Often, this is a way to get the job done while waiting for Washington to come up with a plan that will affect the entire country. Thanks, Michelle and Tony. This has been a great discussion today. As we wrap up, let's leave the audience with some takeaways and action items to improve their PA appeals process. Michelle, can you start off?
Yes. Well, denials happen. Even though I know they're very frustrating for us to go through, they do happen. But the key is that we understand why the denial is occurring, and then begin to build the case to get the approval that is needed. Successful appeal letters include the detailed information about the disease course, the severity, medications that are tried and failed, and procedure results that confirm the patient's extent of disease as well as the severity. And support and supplement the patient data with clinical trials that are evidence-based on literature and journal articles. That is key, to be sure that you add that to the denial letter.
In addition, if a peer-to-peer is required, I think you should approach this as an opportunity to present a prepared case for the medical need for your patient for this particular medication. If the medication is still denied, then take the opportunity to utilize the patient assistance programs that are available. And keep open communication with the patient during this process. Michelle mentioned this earlier in the program, and I really think that's key because prior authorizations do not happen overnight, and the patient can often be left wondering, what stage of the process are we in and how long can they expect this to take? And finally, ultimately, this is all about patient care, so make sure you do your best to get through the process and don't give up.
We hope that we've given you the tools necessary to advocate for the patient and navigate the appeals process. We do, however, recognize that payers need to control healthcare costs. We as providers need to be a partner in this process and not an adversary. I'd like to thank Michelle and Tony for this very practical discussion and for sharing their insights, experience, and strategies for maneuvering the prior authorization appeals process. Please visit the Gastroenterology Digital Hub at cmeoutfitters.com, where you will find all three modules, as well as template letters, checklists, and spreadsheets to help you build or improve your process. You'll also find a video for patients explaining what they can expect from the process that you and your patient may find helpful. And remember, for those who complete the full series, CME Outfitters will award a certificate of excellence in prior authorization. We sincerely hope that we were able to provide you with the tools to improve your processes, allowing more time for patient education, meeting patients' medical needs, and improving the outcomes of our patients with inflammatory bowel disease.